Hey, Water Coolians! Welcome back to another episode of this here podcast. In today's episode, we are joined by author Dr. Elaine Shatner. Her latest work, From Whispers to Shouts, The Way We Talk About Cancer, examines the profound impact of perception. You know, the stories and narratives we tell ourselves and, you know, we tell each other surrounding the patient's treatment journey with cancer. In our first news story, we discussed the historical portrayal of cancer in media dating all the way back to 1921, tracing that impact on shaping the public perception on diagnosis, treatment, mortality, and the cause and effect of quote-unquote writing for entertainment, and how that has influenced our societal attitudes, you know, despite the potential lack of accuracy that writing may have. I think that point has become more than apparent following the news about Kate Middleton's cancer diagnosis, especially the wildly inaccurate rumors that were spreading leading up to the announcement. I think I had heard at one point people thought she had been abducted by aliens. So there you go. But it directs to a bigger conversation about how easily media can sway our viewpoints on various ideas, something to keep in mind as we head into the election season here in the United States. But as we continue to discuss throughout the episode, there is immense importance in building community. Elaine, in her book and in this conversation, mentions how support groups and advocacy groups really were and continue to be at the forefront of creating awareness and positive change. If we talk to one another, we don't tend to hate one another as much. And finally, we go another round with the continued integration of AI into our daily lives as we talk about the recent developments around Google DeepMind's AIMI, an artificial intelligence system designed to provide patients with clear language around their medical conditions during general doctor visits. I will continue to say, AI has a multitude of benefits that we can incorporate into our daily lives, but there needs to be that self-check that we don't forego the human connection and have it replaced by technology. As, you know, more and more stories are written about the increasing loneliness epidemic, it's essential that we continue to be social creatures. We continue to follow the biology of being social and not fall into that abyss of human-machine connection only. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is episode 95 of Water Cooler Talk Podcast titled Perception Diagnosis with
Elaine Shatner.
Enjoy.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.
I thought of cancer as an often fatal condition. And I should say also I knew people who had been treated for cancer who suffered serious side effects from the treatment. Later on, after medical school, most of the stories that I learned about cancer were from my patients. There, as an oncologist, I practiced for a long time, I had an intimate view, really. It was a privilege to get to know people as they faced difficult diagnoses and to try and help them and to be near them and near their families in conversations and physically near them around the time that they would die or that they would recover. And, you know, the patients who did well then were forever grateful, and that was gratifying. The third set of experiences really is my own, and those came after my personal diagnosis of breast cancer and the surgery and chemotherapy that I had.
I remember in high school where, you know, we did like Relay for Life every year, but it was portrayed as cancer was this big, bad, evil that we found a cure, but then we didn't. But then we found a cure for something. And then, you know, another treatment came. But, you know, having friends and, you know, family impacted by cancer, you're always like, wow, this just seems like it's this big, bad that's taking down everybody. But then you also hear these stories of people beating cancer, and you're hearing, I think, more and more and more as, you know, obviously the medical advancements gets better. But when you're young and you get this, you know, idea in your mind that cancer is this unbeatable foe, it does take some time to really hearing those stories of people beating cancer and, you know, surviving and living healthy, good lives to really flip the switch on all those, you know, things you've learned when you're really young.
That's true, I believe. And I know there's a generational effect. So for someone there was nothing worse than a cancer diagnosis. Compared to other serious illnesses, say a stroke or a heart attack, those were all mentionable and something that no one wanted but could be dealt with. And I think that for someone of my generation, cancer is still a big deal. And it's always, I mean, any serious medical condition is worth considering in depth and not dismissing. But I think now that many cancers can be managed with pills and without chemotherapy, cancer may be considered along the lines of other conditions and more like a chronic disease, not in all instances. So there are people who will still, you know, die, unfortunately, from cancer because we don't have good treatments for some forms of it. But these days, most people who receive a cancer diagnosis can go on and live for many years. And that was not the case even 20 years ago. So I think perception is changing slowly as people in their daily lives see other people who are living longer despite having cancer and are even living well with their cancer.
Well, Elaine, are you ready to talk about cancer's perception in films and TV and the impact it's having on patients?
Sure.
All right. This first news story comes from us from LA Times Daily Pilot, written by Lily Nguyen, January 19th, 2024. Films featuring cancer stories can scare patients. While some cancer patients may have experience with the disease through friends or family members, others have gathered information only from what they've seen portrayed on film. Oncologist Dr. David Benjamin, along with his co-authors, conducted a study titled Hollywood's Take on Oncology, examining over 100 films released between 2010 and 2020 to understand the discrepancies between a movie's portrayal of cancer and real-life clinical realities. Dr. Benjamin commented, quote, "As recently as last week, I had a patient tell me that they had watched a movie and in the movie that a character was diagnosed with only a few weeks to live, but the type wasn't specified and it created a lot of uncertainty. The patient told me it created a lot of anxiety and stress when he first heard the diagnosis and then thought about the film. That's really what the impetus of this study was," end quote. Their research focused on films specifically tagged as involving cancer on the IMDb database, including titles like The Fault in Our Stars, 50-50, and Deadpool. Shockingly, they observed approximately 65% of patients depicted in these films were shown as having incurable cancer. Dr. Benjamin continues, quote, "There's not big statistics out there, but in our own experiences, there are a lot of men and women who have early stage cancers that can be treated before they ever see a medical oncologist. When we were writing this article, we wanted to contrast it with real world data. Cancer's changed a lot over the decade," end quote. The findings challenge the accuracy of Hollywood's portrayal of cancer. The National Cancer Institute reports that survivorship has been on the incline since the 1990s. Yet, inaccurate depictions in films can exacerbate anxieties and misconceptions surrounding cancer diagnoses. Dr. Benjamin concludes, quote, "Because there's a lot of ambiguity in films, like with the type of cancer, whether it's curable or the types of treatments, lack of clarity or clear plan causes a lot of anxiety and stress. They may depict cancer as this ambiguous disease, but really it's complicated. Each type of cancer is complicated from how it's treated, to the stage that dictates how curable it is, and the many types of new treatments," end quote. So Elaine, in your book, From Whispers to Shouts, The Way We Talk About Cancer, you trace the evolution of the public's perception of cancer over, you know, the past century and change, obviously intertwining the timeline with this article. How big of a role did Hollywood have in shaping that perception as its growth and influence grew from the 1920s and onwards? I know you have mentioned the silent film, The Reward of Courage, as an inspiration to your work.
I was fascinated by The Reward of Courage, which was the earliest film about cancer that I'm aware of.
And that was 1921, correct?
Yeah, yes, that's right. And actually, it was really a propaganda film in a way, because The Reward of Courage was produced with funds from the early American Cancer Society. And it had a very positive message about cancer treatment. Back then, there were no medical treatments for cancer. Surgery was the only option. And what the Cancer Society wanted people to know is that people shouldn't fear the knife. And so that story is about a woman who summons the courage to have surgery for breast cancer, a mastectomy presumably, and then lives at least 6 years, she's shown later, in a garden with her grandchild. So it's a happy ending. I think that that representation of breast cancer was early, if you will, and optimistic, in the sense that there were reasons in 1921, as there are now, to fear the knife, to fear surgery, to be cautious. And back then, the results were pretty dismal after cancer surgery. But that was the message. By contrast, the films you talk about and that article to which you refer, review of the past decade, those films, I think, tend to reflect what the public thinks about cancer. I'm not sure people learn about cancer from films so much as the films reflect what the, you know, those are Hollywood films, Stars and Deadpool, et cetera. So those films are made by people who are not physicians or not particularly affiliated with any cancer organizations. And I think there the agenda is to tell a good story, which may involve a lethal disease or someone's recovery from cancer. I found it very interesting to watch a lot of films. And in writing my book, I mean, my poor husband, he suffered through dozens that we watched together, and some more than once. And there was definitely a progression such that, like in 1983, which Terms of Endearment came out, which for a person my age was an important movie. And that was about a relationship between a mother and a daughter and the things that happen and the mother's lover. Anyway, and in that movie, it's understood that the character portrayed by Deborah Winger will die from her cancer. And the diagnosis is just tragic. And although the young woman who's affected says it's not. And I have two sons who are grown now, but I remember at the time of my cancer diagnosis, I thought back on the scene in that movie when the protagonist with cancer is in the hospital and she puts on makeup. She's been getting chemotherapy and it's not working. And it's clear she's going to die. And her two sons come and visit her in the hospital. And, you know, I often thought back on that scene when I was getting my cancer treatment, because I guess I thought about losing, you know, my sons, and I didn't want them to lose me. That was very memorable for someone of my age, and you know, my demographic, if you will. Now there's a whole range of outcomes for people who have cancer. So in that article that you mentioned, there's a reference to the movie 50-50, and the title tells you that it's not a given that the character with cancer will die. He might survive or he might not. And it's like that on television now quite often, although as the researchers in that paper found, which matches really what I observed, cancer is not realistically represented in most films. I mean, it happens on occasion, but that would be the exception.
And I think you absolutely nailed it when you talked about, you know, obviously with movies and Hollywood TV shows, even going to shows like, you know, Grey's Anatomy, ER, they're made for entertaining an audience. They're not always made for entertaining an audience on information, because, you know, as we see with documentaries, not everyone loves watching a documentary because sometimes it's so dense with information. Sometimes, you know, we just want to turn our brains off, quote unquote, and watch something. And so whether it be, you know, The Fault in Our Stars, whether it be 50-50, Deadpool, Grey's Anatomy, as I mentioned, these are shows that are built for entertainment first, not for, you know, obviously they want to try to do the best they can to be somewhat accurately correct, so things actually feel, you know, like they're in a reality we can ground ourselves in. But for the most part, their job, the show writer's job, is to make sure that that, you know, show or that movie is entertaining. And it is, you know, using sometimes cancer as a plot point, a story progression. And it creates, I mean, as obviously your book and this article kind of explain, it creates this unrealistic standard of what cancer is. And as I think more people take cues from Hollywood, I mean, even that latest Napoleon movie by Ridley Scott, very historically inaccurate, but now people are going to be like, oh, I want to learn about Napoleon. I'll just watch this film by Ridley Scott. And now that's in their mind of who Napoleon was, even though it does have these inaccuracies.
I think that's right. The whole topic of fictional biographies and fiction, you know, the blurriness of fiction and nonfiction now is problematic. It gets beyond, I guess, our subject for today. I would offer one thing you mentioned is that people don't like watching documentaries about cancer. I was watching, I don't recall which season it was, of Ted Lasso. There's like this little girl who's Roy's niece, I think.
Yep.
She's basically forced, after doing something, you know, misbehaving in some way, or maybe her language was the problem, she's forced to watch movies or read about cancer. That's her punishment. She said, oh, I had spent like so many hours hearing about cancer. And it was given as a punishment for whatever it was she had done. I haven't thought about that in a while, but yeah. And in fact, in the 1920s, when the early cancer society started handing out literature about cancer and organizing lectures in communities to raise cancer awareness, there was discussion in the society's bulletins about people's willingness to go to those events. And so there were events organized by clubs like the Rotary and Kiwanis, and there were church events and synagogue events all about cancer in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And the society people noted that people seemed to be coming volitionally and did not feel pressured. I mean, I would say that the fact that they had to write that suggests that there indeed was social pressure to go to these events sponsored by organizations, and that really people don't particularly care to read or hear about cancer. I think that's understandable and for the most part true.
When I think it goes back to kind of what we had talked about earlier is creating this perception of cancer as this big bad. And it's kind of easy, you know, I mean, I've done plenty of writing on, you know, web series and kind of wanting to do TV shows. And you understand that I need this some sort of conflict. And how do I go about that conflict? Oh, cancer, because there's so many different iterations of cancer. There's so many different dialogues around cancer. That's the thing, is everybody in the world, I truly believe this, everybody in the world has been affected by cancer or knows somebody who's been affected by cancer. And so it becomes this very relatable topic that can be used for, you know, this conflict reason. But also at the same time, you know, when you're putting out these inaccuracies, it does, I mean, as you've talked about, it does impact the mental health of patients who are getting these diagnoses and their ability to cope with, you know, this life change, because they're going as like, oh my gosh, I saw 50-50. Now that's in my mind of I have a 50-50 chance to live, even though as medical treatments get better and better and better, and the understanding of how to treat these cancers get better and better, the survival rate, as I mean, the article mentioned, has been going up since the 1990s.
Yes, I think there's been huge progress. I know there has been in my lifetime. And that's both exciting and it's really wonderful. I have many friends and acquaintances, and statistics speak to the fact that people are living longer after cancer diagnosis. The cancer death rate in the United States and in other high-income countries, the cancer death rate has decreased markedly since 1990. That's in part because people are smoking less and the lung cancer rate is way down. And lung cancer was a very lethal cancer. It still is. But it's also because treatments have improved. We're better at detecting cancer early when it can be more effectively and easily treated. There are many factors in why cancer death rates are down, but it is a fact. And I think people get that now in a way that they maybe did not just 5 years ago. I worry sometimes with film and television that it's not just whether people will die or not, you know, and if people perceive cancer as a death sentence, but sometimes on TV, for instance, you'll see someone make a decision to forego chemotherapy because they believe that the treatment won't work and that the treatment is worse than the disease. And I think that attitudes about the treatment and fear of cancer treatment persist very much as they did years ago, with some reason. I mean, chemotherapy drugs are not easy to take, and the newer drugs, about which I, you know, consider in my book and elsewhere, I've written about those. Many of the new cancer drugs are easier to take than the old drugs that you see given in movies, where people, you know, are seen retching and losing their hair and all that. But the drugs are still mixed, and some have significant toxic effects, side effects. And I'm optimistic that in the near future, the drugs will continue to improve and that doctors will get better at prescribing them in ways that are less onerous for people who are affected. But I think my point is that the fear of treatment of cancer persists, and sort of dread of the chemotherapy and other treatments still influence people's decisions, understandably. So people may think, oh, I have a good chance now, but they dread the treatment. That's still happens.
Yeah. And to that point, you know, that fear of treatment, even, you know, I know you wrote about lung cancer in Breaking Bad and how if it was put out today, obviously medical treatments have advanced so well that it would be hard to make it make sense that Walter White, Bryan Cranston's character, has lung cancer. And obviously, I think in the article, you also talk about obviously the sky high medical prices that we face here in the US, but it wouldn't be as a believable story because of how much the medical treatments have progressed. And I think in today's information age, where there is so much information, there's new developments every day, we're understanding these developments in basically the moment the development happens, it's out to the world. And now we're all theorizing on what it could do, you know, for the world. And it's crazy to see how quickly information becomes outdated in this time period. So if you're writing a show or a movie and, you know, there's a plot point about cancer, by the time that probably comes out, all the information that you've put into it is more than likely outdated. And so how have you been seeing this perception of cancer change as this information boom has really pushed its way into pretty much outdating something as soon as it goes out to the audience?
The rapidity of advances against cancer is hard to conceive. There's been just so much progress. And so you refer to Breaking Bad, and the point that I make and that I stand by, that the Walter White would need a different diagnosis today to carry that plot line that he's doing about his lung cancer. The financial toxicity that he fears is real, and that would be a true problem now. I think that the costs of cancer care are becoming paramount as the disease becomes more treatable and even curable. You know, 100 years ago, there were very few cancer treatments, and really people didn't worry about the costs because it kind of didn't matter if you took them or not, with exception. Now that there are treatments that often work, the costs become limiting. And I think that's really unfortunate. And I don't know how political you want to get here, but with, you know, the current administration's push to regulate drug costs through, I think, is terrific and essential. Mm-hmm. As far as progress and keeping up with that, it's not just in movies where the storylines don't keep up with what's treatable and new drugs, but even in the medical literature. And I think so it's hard for doctors to keep up with what's new, even in a subspecialty. It used to be that there were a lot of general oncologists who would take care of people who had, say, breast cancer and lung cancer and prostate cancer and colon cancer and leukemia. And now in most of the better cancer centers, doctors really focus on one kind of cancer because there are so many drugs and details about the treatment of each that they have to know about. Patients prefer people, doctors who are more specialized. For doctors to give the best care, they really do have to subspecialize in that way. What I would say, though, is that patients themselves are increasingly learning about their cancer subtypes. So with what's called precision oncology, where the cancer forms are labeled not just by the location or body part that they are, in which they arise, like the lung or the liver, mm-hmm. but cancers are named based on some of the molecular changes in the cells, the genetic aspects and other molecules they may have. Those molecular details of the cancer may determine which treatment will work more so than the body part that the cancer comes from. And so patients themselves are taking it on to learn about their cancer subtypes, like breast cancer with something called HER2 and with a BRCA mutation, which is a genetic disposition to cancer, or without that mutation. And then there are subsets there. Some patients will take it upon themselves to learn detailed information about their exact cancer type, and they will, you know, receive Google alerts and other kinds of updates on their specific cancer type because they don't trust that their doctors will be able to keep up with what's new for and available for their particular case. And so you have now with the internet and also with medical conferences opening up to patients, you have people who are learning directly about their cancer types and reading sort of science as it happens, if you will, so that they can be sure to, you know what their options are. I don't know if that makes sense. I think the movies are really a sideshow in that regard. I don't think they're not nearly up to date in those sorts of things.
No, I 100% agree with you there. And obviously that kind of goes into, you know, our second news story, you know, when it comes to how do we help physicians get more specialized care, because there is only, you know, 24 hours in a day and you don't want, you know, your doctors overworked, burnt out. You know, I know you talked about the relationship with a doctor over the holidays, but, you know, when it comes to this precision oncology, you know, being able to really get to the molecular details of it, how do you see that developing and being educated to the public in a way? Is it something that, you know, show writers should be more aware of when writing shows that these developments are coming out? Or is it up to physicians, oncologists? Is it up to, I mean, as we'll talk about a little bit later, you know, with the women's movement in the 20th century to talk about these grassroots initiatives, what kind of is that next step as, you know, science is happening to educate the public?
I think it would be fantastic if the movies could refer to cancers in more detail. That's one of the points made by the authors of the article you mentioned. And Love Story, right? The word leukemia is not said. It's understood that Ally McBeal's character has a cancer. And in fact, Susan Sontag, in her book, Illness as Metaphor, refers to the fact that leukemia was considered a clean cancer type. And that's why it was chosen in Love Story, because there was nothing offensive. You didn't have to use the word colon or breast, et cetera.
Interesting.
In the article that you mentioned, the authors talk about lack of detail, that in a storyline on, you know, in the movie, a patient often will just have cancer and they don't say what kind it is, which isn't really helpful to people. Although I don't know that it's less helpful than it would be if it represented a certain cancer and gave the wrong treatment or said that it was lethal when it was not.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of vagueness there. But if you could have a character learn, for instance, that her cancer had a certain genetic switch or fusion, say, that made her tumor vulnerable to a new drug. And if the storyline involved then her getting that drug on a clinical trial, or something like that, that might be helpful in that people would think, oh, maybe I should find out about the genetics of my tumor and ask my doctor about that, because a lot of doctors still don't routinely get genetic information or what's called molecular profiling of tumors. It's still a small fraction of patients who get sort of maximal evaluation of their tumors in the laboratory. And I think that's a shame, because I think a lot of people might benefit from drugs they don't even know would match their tumor. So if Hollywood and other media producers, I guess, would carry those sorts of storylines, it would be helpful. It's less necessary maybe than it was in the 80s, because with the internet, certainly in places like North America, people go online and look for information. Patients help one another online. And some people don't want to know. They don't want to look. There are people who still don't Google their diseases. But if someone is looking for input and looking for advice, they will come upon support groups that are very focused in providing information and resources for patients that they might understand, and sort of sharing notes, if you will, on very particular disease types. And so there are even Facebook pages, for instance, on subtypes of lung cancer based on specific genetic features of the lung cancer. So, and the same for breast cancer. You can find a Facebook group or multiple ones for a triple negative breast cancer and for inflammatory breast cancer, and then for breast cancer with certain molecular features, or for people who are taking a certain drug. I would just caution people to beware. Some of those pages, and they're not all Facebook, there's some just web pages where you get information. Some of those are sponsored by companies to provide information about their drugs. And it's not always obvious that the pages are industry sponsored.
I kind of love how you wrap this conversation up. And I do want to add, obviously, too, the importance of hearing the true stories of cancer survivors. I mean, these badass stories that you don't need to really Hollywoodize. Obviously, as you know, working within the journalism field, you know, having that firsthand account is so, so important to properly telling a story and properly getting the information out. Because if you're someone who's never really dealt with something and then you're trying to write about it, it's not going to be great. But I would like to welcome to the show Dr. Elaine Shatner. a dynamic voice at the crossroads of medicine and advocacy. Elaine's latest book, From Whispers to Shouts, The Way We Talk About Cancer, offers a profound exploration of public perceptions surrounding cancer. As a cancer survivor and former oncologist, Elaine's commitment to medical ethics and equitable healthcare resonates through her work. Elaine, welcome to Water Cooler Talk.
Thanks so much, Adam.
In your book, as I previously mentioned, you explore the grassroots initiatives led by women's organizations in the 20th century, such as the General Federation of Women's Clubs, working with the American Society for the Control of Cancer, the inspiring story of Dr. Anna C. Palmer creating the Cured Cancer Club, and her quote, "We were cured because we refused to sit back and think of cancer as disgraceful to ourselves and our families." I mean, even going further back into your work, you know, Shirley Temple's decision to speak openly about her breast cancer diagnosis mere days after going through surgery. How did these initiatives challenge societal norms? And really, what are the lasting impacts these efforts had on reshaping the public perception of the disease?
There's been a huge shift in how people talk about cancer. And you mentioned Dr. Anna C. Palmer, who's really a hero of my book and of mine personally. And she was a physician whose story I tell because she was so brave. In 1920, she had breast cancer and a surgery for that, presumably a mastectomy. And what she did that very few people did at the time was she was open about it. And in the 1920s, she went to women's clubs and she spoke about her experiences having surgery. And she later said that really people didn't want to hear about it, but she persisted. And in 1938, she formed what was called the Cured Cancer Club. The purpose of the Cured Cancer Club was to inform the public, to persuade people that cancer was curable. In 1938, when Dr. Palmer formed this club, most people thought of cancer as a death sentence, and they did because for the most part it was. If you look at the survival rates, published statistics from that era, most people died within a year, 1 or 2 years of a cancer diagnosis, even with breast cancer. I mean, there were very few people who lived long after a cancer diagnosis. It was almost unheard of. And what Dr. Palmer did was she created this group with criteria for membership. You had to have what she called a verified case, meaning that the pathology had to be reviewed by a legitimate physician. And you had to be alive at least 5 years after treatment for that cancer. And treatment had to be given by a reputable physician, meaning not a quack at that time. So you had to have what she considered a valid cancer diagnosis and have had either surgery or radiation or radium treatments, which were the only established treatments then. The 5-year survival was considered important because that conferred a message that people could do all right for at least some years, that you wouldn't die immediately, and that it was worth getting treatment for cancer. The club members went on the radio, they had their photographs taken, and they had to publicly list their names and some other aspects of their lives. There was a lot of shame then about having cancer. People believed, even though the Cancer Society said that cancer was not inherited, people believed that it did run in families, and they feared sort of marking their families by a cancer diagnosis. Many felt that they were a burden with a cancer diagnosis, and they felt some people, including some doctors, believed that cancer happened as a consequence of misbehavior or some sort of divine retribution for doing bad things or evil. And so there was a lot of shame and stigma surrounding cancer. Also, people thought cancer was contagious. And so people did not want to come forward with their personal cancer narrative, so to speak. And I think Dr. Palmer and the Cured Cancer Club did a lot to sort of get things going. And there were clubs that formed around the country. World War II put a bit of a damper on the momentum around cancer patient advocacy at that time. And Dr. Palmer died in her 80s during World War II. But as I describe in the book, in the 1950s, these cured cancer clubs popped up around North America and in Canada. There's a metaphor really where they metastasized, if you will. They were successful, so successful, in fact, that Senator Prescott Bush of Connecticut, George's father, the older George Bush, he spoke of the benefits of the Cured Cancer Club when he was giving a lecture in his home state of Connecticut. And he talked about how the club was supportive, that it raised funds, and supplies for people who survived cancer. And he thought it was really terrific and that it should be emulated. In the 60s, there were other advocacy organizations that formed, and people also became more open about cancer and disease in general. There were cultural shifts in the 60s where people just opened up about a lot of things. Cancer became less taboo over time. Dr. Palmer and women's groups were really instrumental in spreading the word. I might mention just the Women's Field Army in the 1930s that was part of the Cancer Society. And Dr. Palmer was involved with that, as were hundreds of thousands of women who took it upon themselves to educate their families and their communities about cancer's curability. And they emphasized the benefits of, or the reported benefits of, early detection and prompt treatment. They wanted to dispel fear of disease by explaining to, in lay terms, that cancer was treatable.
It's so interesting reading, you know, this type of work, the type of work you're putting out. And once again, just always being reminded of the importance of building community and being able to freely express who you are and being able to say, well, you know, I'm struggling with rent this week. Oh, I'm struggling with rent. Okay, now we're sharing in the empathy of, we both understand each other's situation, and we can build, you know, obviously, like in this situation, we can build coalitions that help get awareness out there, right? Obviously, the importance of awareness. And it is always interesting to see women at the forefront of medical developments because, I mean, as I've talked about in a previous episode with Katya Lovejoy, obviously a better connection to the earth and, you know, finding remedies and people not liking that and being like, well, you're witches and we're going to burn you because you're a witch. When really it was just a more better connection to the earth and better connection to how we go about treating one another and building those communities. And I even remember talking about how the term gossip started was because during the agricultural revolution, as, you know, men were busy tending their farms, the women were back at home mending the house, and they would talk to each other and they would build this community, and they would be like, well, my husband did this. Oh, your husband did this. Don't let him do that. And then this term gossip became structured to be a negative. Like, why are you gossiping with Mary Jane down the street? You shouldn't be doing that. And that control. But when really we see these grassroots initiatives where communities are built, and obviously they're facing, you know, struggles and they're facing roadblocks, but when they find success, we realize the importance of the message they're building and how it's changing, going back to kind of this whole conversation of changing the public perception. It's changing the perception when we allow these communities to build, when we allow people to talk with one another and share their experiences. And I think, you know, obviously in today's day and age of the loneliness epidemic, we are missing that, but we can go back in history and see that when we are taking the time to build these communities, we find success in building positive awareness that's not, you know, the fault in our stars that has the completely wrong idea of what cancer is. And even going to situations like, I remember, I know you did some work in AIDS treatment and AIDS research. And back in the day, when you got that diagnosis that you had AIDS, that was basically a death sentence. And then we get, you know, Princess Diana, I believe, interacting with an AIDS patient. And people are like, okay, I can actually interact with this person and not immediately die. But that fear was created because we didn't take the time to build the proper communities to have those conversations and share those stories.
Absolutely. I think the openness about HIV, Princess Diana's handshake, if you will, was at the time a big deal because there was a huge amount of fear surrounding the virus that causes AIDS. And she helped to dissipate that. And she set an example about communities and speaking up and grassroots support. If you think about it, in recent years, there's been a lot more openness about mental health. And I think that it's clear that that makes it easier for people to ask for help. Now, imagine if we weren't open about cancer anymore. If someone had to go get chemotherapy and they were ashamed of having, say, breast cancer, that would make it harder to go for the treatments, to go to the doctor, to go if you choose to get screened, to go for your follow-up appointments. The openness enables care in many communities. Where there used to be embarrassment, now people can just go about getting their treatment. I had patients when I was in practice who asked me not to call them at home with various conditions, but that was because they didn't want their partner or you know, someone to know about their diagnosis. That may still happen today. And I think there may be a tendency to protect some loved ones from some information if it's a serious condition. But at the community level, people can get support now in a way that they could not some decades ago. And I think women's organizations were very helpful, really instrumental in pushing cancer care and support to proximity for most people who are affected. I describe that, you know, because breast cancer is so common and because it's one of the more treatable cancers and was one of the more survivable cancers in the 60s and 70s, you ended up with a lot of volunteer organizations that were basically staffed by women who had had early breast cancer and survived. And that they were disproportionate in the cancer support community. And a lot of the earliest advocacy groups were really about breast cancer, if you will. In general, it's said that men are less open about themselves and about health. And so it took a while, really till the 1990s, that men started being more open about prostate cancer, which is a common diagnosis, although it tends to affect men who are older on average than breast cancer affects women, but still. And I described the opening up in the 90s, essentially 20 years after the breast cancer awareness movement started. When men started being open about prostate cancer, and you had people like celebrities who would share their stories, and groups like Us Too, which were men's support groups for those affected. And still, there are some cancers for which there are very few support groups. And I find it interesting that they're largely for cancers where survivorship is low because the treatments are still less effective. So, for example, pancreatic cancer, there were very few support groups and very few advocacy groups compared to those others I mentioned. And sadly, that's because very few people survived long with pancreatic cancer. A lot of people feel grateful if they have a cancer diagnosis and they do well, they want to give back to the community. Mm-hmm. Well, with something like pancreatic cancer, until recently, there were very few people who lived long. And so there was those organizations came later, and they were mainly financial. They were mainly surviving relatives of people who formed foundations to raise money for research. There were not so many organizations for people who were living with those conditions. And that's all changing as people with many cancer forms and particular subtypes are living longer. But there's an interaction actually between the treatments and these advocacy groups, which I find interesting. The patients now are in some ways even directing research because many are participating with scientists on committees that assign research funds.
Do you think there's almost a shame that our culture, specifically here in the US, has created around being sick or not being healthy or not being able to be a productive member of the society? Because, I mean, even going to kind of what that conversation you were having about, you know, men not being as open, I do believe there's a big change in the shift, you know, in modern day times. I mean, I don't know if you know who Rhett and Link are, but they're huge people on the internet, but they got a colonoscopy together and they filmed it and they're putting it out to the internet to show like, hey, this is a normal thing that men at a certain age should be getting. But then at the same time, we come out of a pandemic where you would think things would change around washing hands and if you're sick, taking time off of work. But it almost seems like we're still stuck in the shame around you can't be sick because you need to be a productive member of the society.
Many people, not all, but many people with serious health conditions do still feel embarrassed. I mean, I've been a patient most of my life. I've written about this. I had severe scoliosis diagnosed when I was 6, and I wore a brace for years as a girl. It didn't work. It was this awkward, ugly thing that I wore. I was in the hospital when I was 14 for about 6 weeks. I had a big spine surgery. I got 7 units of blood. I developed a blood clot. I wore a body cast for most of a year. And between the brace and the body cast, you know, I always sort of stood out medically from other kids. And then that led me to be somewhat open about my health conditions because you couldn't miss them. At the same time, I think I've always felt, this gets very deep, but it makes me feel both more valued and less valued. So, you know, those experiences make me what I am and who I am. But I don't like being disabled. I don't like the feeling of not being able to do things. And when I had to stop practicing medicine as a consequence of a series of conditions, that really almost killed me because I loved my work so much. Basically, I felt that I was robbed of my career. That was an awful feeling. I wanted to be productive. I still do. You know, so I understand those feelings very deeply. And I think in the end, where how I've come to terms with it is that, you know, we each get some cards, and I've been lucky in some of mine and not so much in others. And so I understand what you're saying. I think there's a huge stigma around illness and disability. And I myself have at times felt inadequate as a consequence of those things. And I can imagine, you know, just due to cultural norms and stereotypes that may be a more prevalent sentiment among men. You know, I was raised that I should earn a living and take care of myself, be productive. And also because I identified as a doctor so strongly, not being able to practice, I felt gutted. And it took me years to get over that, you know, stopping practice. So yeah, I hear what you're saying very much.
First off, Elaine, I so much appreciate you sharing that. And I mean, it means so much that you're comfortable sharing this on with me. And I don't want to really add anything to that because I feel like I'll ruin it in some way. But before we move on, myself and Water Cooler Talk have embarked upon a mission to give back to various parts of the community and those who have helped build our show to where it stands today. For each new episode of the podcast, the guests will bring with them a charity of their choice to represent. On the day of their episode going live, Water Cooler Talk will give a donation to that charity in honor of the guests, as well as a global platform to spread a message of love, hope, and togetherness. And we invite you listening to this episode to join in to help spread that message to your own personal audience. Elaine, your charity of choice for today's episode is Every Town for Gun Safety. Can you share with us, you know, the significance of their work in this space and the impact that's being made by those who are in support?
Well, Adam, I appreciate the chance to recommend this organization. Gun control is dear to me, as it might be for anyone who lives in New York City or North America. I see gun violence as a public health concern. And just related to medicine, I was teaching or giving an exam on the day of that many children were killed in Connecticut. And it was an exam for medical students. And I remember thinking, what's the point of all this medical education if people can go around with guns and kill children and teachers in an elementary school? Gun deaths are preventable. And in my view, if any of your listeners can support any organization that works for better gun laws and gun control, that would be meaningful and save lives.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing on Every Town for Gun Safety onto the show today and being able to obviously reference them. And obviously that reference to Sandy Hook in Connecticut, where changes obviously were apparent that need to be made. And it's taking a lot longer than I think a lot of people like. And yeah, I think there needs to be more pressure on, you know, politicians and local leaders to make those changes from, you know, a travesty that happened too long ago, but also at the same time continues to happen too often. All right, Elaine, are you ready to switch up focuses a little bit, get back into the news stories here?
Absolutely.
All right, this is from IEEE Spectrum News, written by Sarah Wells, January 25th, 2024. Google's new AI is learning to diagnose patients. Navigating healthcare systems as a patient can be daunting at the best of times. Whether you're interpreting jargon-filled diagnoses or determining which specialist to see next, similarly, doctors often have grueling schedules that make it difficult to offer personalized attention to all their patients. These issues only increase in areas with limited physicians and medical infrastructure. Since IBM's Watson debut on Jeopardy in 2011, researchers have been exploring the potential of AI to revolutionize healthcare. Now, Google DeepMind, an artificial intelligence research laboratory, has introduced Articulate Medical Intelligence Explorer, or AMI for short, designed to provide patients with clear explanations of medical conditions during wellness visits. While AMI isn't intended to replace human physicians, Google AI research Vivek Natarajan believes it could assist both patients and doctors. He states, quote, "There may be scenarios when people might benefit from interacting with systems like AMI as part or in addition to their clinical journeys. These include understanding symptoms and conditions better, including simplifying explanations in local vernaculars and acting as a valuable second opinion," end quote. To bring AMI up to speed without sending it through 8 years of medical school, and obviously loads of debt at that point, it was fed with real-world medical texts, including transcripts of nearly 100,000 real physician-patient dialogues, thousands of medical reasoning questions taken from the United States Medical Licensing Examination and allowed access to a simulated diagnostic environment for self-learning. This environment would allow for Amy to refine his behavior through continuous feedback loops. While Natarajan stresses that there is no substitute for real human experience and connection, the extensive training regimen does give Amy a leg up in some ways over human physicians. For example, a physician may see only 10,000 or so patients in their career, but Amy could, quote unquote, see that many patients in just a couple of training cycles. In a blind trial comparing Amy to 20 human primary care providers, Amy demonstrated higher diagnostic accuracy and performance, particularly in live text consultations where it gave longer and more thoughtful responses, which was considered more time intensive by patients. However, researchers acknowledged the need for further testing, including face-to-face interactions and video chats. While AI like Amy shows promise in improving healthcare accessibility and efficiency, there are ethical considerations. Thomas Thiessen, creator of the AI Patient Actor app, emphasized the importance of integrating AI literacy into medical education to ensure responsible use. He states, quote, "Medical schools have a responsibility to incorporate AI literacy into their curriculum. This includes understanding the ethical implications to ensure that as AI becomes more integrated into clinical practice, future doctors can use it responsibly and protect their patients' well-being," end quote. Looking ahead, researchers at Google DeepMind aim to enhance Amy's capabilities and address issues of fairness and equity. As technology continues to reshape medicine, proactive preparation and ethical awareness will be crucial for healthcare professionals. Elaine, in your works, you've mentioned meeting with writer Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, a memoir of her parents' end-of-life experiences and the challenges they faced, setting the foundation for this article and our conversation about this article. How does that conversation begin when discussing the doctor-patient relationship and transitioning it to patient empowerment, patient-led healthcare, you know, particularly in, you know, the complex situations akin to those that were described in Katie Butler's book?
Well, it's been a while since I read that book, Adam, and I know then that you must have read my blog, Medical Lessons.
I did a deep dive. Every guest gets a deep dive.
Well, I'm impressed. I see a lot of potential for AI to help in medical care, to improve the quality of medical care and to help doctors and to help patients. That said, I don't see the role for AI in deep conversations, sort of philosophical aspects of medicine, as she approaches in her book and work. So when you talk about end-of-life situations and whether to be aggressive in medical care or not, those are highly charged, very emotional and value-loaded personal conversations that at least I as a patient would only want to have with my doctor and loved ones. I don't really see how AI could help with that. And I worry about technology and medicine rendering patients more like objects. So I know when I've been hospitalized sometimes with a lot of machines, the experience can be dehumanizing. So this is apart from the artificial intelligence question, but just when you have someone who's at the end of life, if they end up in a care unit or with just a lot of monitors and, you know, medical stuff, that at least to me is not the best way out. And I've written about that, and I'm open about the fact when I was 42, I filled out forms because I had to have surgery for my spine again, and I had breast cancer and other things. So I at that age, when my sons were young, you know, I went over with my husband, my closest friends, and my physicians what my wishes were exactly. And there was no AI then. It was 2002. You know, I just wrote out, these are things I do not want done to me, because I feared medicalization at the end of my life. And I think that humanism in medicine is very important, and I share that view with Katie Butler. So I'm not sure how that relates to AI so much, but I would say that now when I interact with my doctors, I like to do so directly. Email's fine, or even text, phone is best, or in person. I can't imagine being satisfied with communications from Amy, which is the Google tool you described, or really any robot or AI system. To me, that would not be gratifying, and I would feel abandoned by my physician. So I see the role of AI in medicine as in providing diagnostic guidance. So you talked about how the Google researchers were able to improve on some aspects of diagnosis and to provide some explanations for patients. That's where I see the potential for AI, and not in the individual decision-making and sort of personal circumstance of people as they just have to make choices in their care. I don't see AI as getting involved there. So I call it the patient-doctor relationship. And to me, it's got to be human, human to human.
I 1,000% agree with you. You know, I think AI has the ability to help physicians and nurses in so many different ways and kind of their day-to-day. But as far as when it comes to the patient-doctor, the patient-nurse relationship, that does have to be human-to-human, because AI is, I mean, maybe eventually it'll improve, but I don't think it'll ever get to the point of, you know, yeah, like you said, having the deep understanding of conversation, the ability to understand emotion, to have empathy. AI will, I mean, knock on wood that it doesn't get too reflexive of what the human condition is, but it always has a coldness to it. And I mean, as you've talked about in a lot of your writings, when you're in, you know, some of the scariest moments of your life, the last thing you want is, you know, quote unquote, the Terminator walking in and being incredibly cold to the situation that is drastically impacting your life and your future. And it is important, you know, I think going into doctors and taking the Hippocratic Oath and their decision to put on that white lab coat is understanding that a part of your job is connecting with your patients. They're not just, you know, another name on your clipboard. They're not just another name in your rotation. That's, I mean, I love the show Scrubs, and I know a lot of medical professionals have said it's one of the most realistic shows, talking back to that first story when we talked about the perception of these decisions, but it's one of the most realistic shows to what the day-to-day life is like, because it really does take the time to say, we are humanizing you as a patient, that the doctors are humanizing you as a patient. You're not just another number. You're not just another, you know, case I have to get through. And I'm sure, you know, there are plenty of doctors that is their mindset and they're more focused elsewhere. But when it comes to providing good adequate care, I think I got it. But when you're looking for that care, you want that time, because even though you may be, you know, one of 10 people that doctor visits that day, that moment in your life is so important. And obviously, as I mentioned, you talked about, you know, being in the hospital on holidays, and we're so used to this idea of on holidays being around loved ones. But then if you happen to be in a hospital around the holidays, it is sometimes tough to feel that love and that joy when you're in this cold room, when you're in this room with things beeping around you, you're in, you know, those robes where, you know, the backside is completely open to the air. I mean, getting great circulation, but I can understand how it can be very isolating and very cold. And then now you're adding in a machine that works off of ones and zeros. You know, it's being used to say, hey, looks like you're going to die tomorrow. All right, on to the next. I mean, that there's nuance to those conversations, and AI just does not have the capability to do that.
I think that AI doesn't have that capability, but I would argue that even if it did, I would not want it taking care of me per se. I would rather that a human tell me what's going on and try to provide words of comfort or assurance or hope or sadness. I want it to be real. Now, of course, I'm privileged in that I have doctors who I think do care about me. And so I was thinking about this when I read the article that you sent about the research. The question really in my mind is, an AI caregiver or doctor-ish robot better than no doctor? Mm. So let's say you don't have a doctor. The circumstances are such that you can't afford one, or that there's just a dearth of doctors, that there are just no doctors available. Or, you know, you might live in a country where there are very few doctors, none with, you know, who can take care of you. For whatever reason, having information provided by an AI device would be better than not having information. And it's sort of like the question of, is something being adequate versus great? So a good doctor, and by that I mean a really great doctor, is better than a robot providing care, or AI, let's say. But if someone has no doctor, or really bad, poorly trained physician who, let's say, you know, is a quack or just gives the wrong medicines, you could argue that AI would be better than that. But in the personal conversations like we were talking about, I would rather a human try and fail to comfort me than to have a robot attempt to tell me things that are personal. I reject that, as I think I would feel abandoned by my physicians if a machine were to inform me of, you know, my test results and other things and the significance of those. I would feel abandoned. There's a huge amount that AI can do, though, but I see that as more behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think we both agree AI in the medical field is very important, but it has to be pointed in the right directions, and it can't just be used to, you know, obviously, yeah, this is an opportunity to provide more affordable healthcare, to help build infrastructures where infrastructures are lacking, you know, to take some time off of a doctor's schedule so, you know, they don't have to focus on something that's not patient related, right? You know, when AI first started, that was the ultimate goal of it, was to be this assistance to humanity. But then obviously, you know, companies start getting involved and the idea of how much money I can make from this starts getting involved. The positives and the benefits to humanity will be overlooked for the profits that it can be given for the short term. And so that's always my fear when I, you know, hear stories like this, is like, how much does a doctor make a year? Quite a bit of money if you're going to school for 8 years. Well, what if I can bring in a, you know, hire 10 less doctors and replace it with Amy? Well, now you have 10 less people being able to support themselves through what they want to do with their life. You have 10 less people that are able to have those personal conversations. And there are importances to having the human doctor to patient relationship, you know, as we've been giving examples here. And at the same time, there is importance to having AI as a part of this field. It's just, we have to be very clear on how we want AI to be a part of that field. Otherwise, it's very easy to go the profit-driven route, and it ends up in a place where we don't want it to end up.
Yeah, well, I think that hospitals are working hard to make doctors more efficient. And I can imagine that administrators see AI as a part of that efficiency push. I don't see it that way. But my goal in medical care is not necessarily the most efficient process. Resources are finite, and we want doctors to, you know, generally run on time. But in my view, having doctors each be responsible for greater numbers of patients is not helpful to doctors, and it's definitely not helpful to the patients, because the doctors don't know their patients anymore. And so if AI were to essentially extend the census, if you will, or, you know, patient count of each doctor, I think that would be really a disservice to everybody involved. The patients and doctors wouldn't know one another. They wouldn't trust one another. They wouldn't care about one another. And I think that the quality of medical care would be diminished. I really do.
Yeah. And I think you had a wonderful quote, and I'll paraphrase a bit here, but you said, at one level, assigning minor and not so minor tasks to other kinds of healthcare providers sounds great. It relieves the physician shortage, lowers healthcare costs. But if doctors are just thinking about your quote unquote case or doing complex procedures and not being the ones to call you back, they spend less time with you. They will not care so much about the outcome of your case. And I think this is, at the very end, super important. When and if a doctor spends time with the patient, that builds trust, concern, and possibly better outcomes. And I think that kind of perfectly wraps up this conversation we're having, in the case of, it is important to have a doctor that takes the time to understand who you are as a person. And I mean, most of the time, I mean, people have a doctor, or, you know, a family doctor, or a small amount of doctors that they're seeing for the majority of their life. Because if you are going to somebody to talk about your health and talk about how that impacts your future, you want to build that trust with someone. So a lot of the times, you know, I actually just switched my medical care and I had to get a new doctor because my old doctor was out of coverage. And I was like, well, shit, am I willing to pay more money to have the doctor I've built this relationship with? Or I had to have that cost benefit analysis, which obviously speaks to the medical health insurance situation here in the US. But people are having those conversations. You know, I would love to go to my family doctor, but they're not in network anymore. So I have to go to another doctor. So I have to build that relationship again. Or over time, I'm building this, you know, relationship with, you know, a family doctor, especially, you know, in smaller towns in the US when they have one doctor for a whole town. But replacing that person with an AI, replacing that relationship is just, it's not going to work.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's unfortunate that so many insurers now and systems, if you will, consider doctors replaceable. If you're a patient who has a doctor who knows you, that's worth so much. And it can't easily be shifted. There's a cost to changing doctors, not just financial. I think there's a cost in the decisions that are made, you know, and the understanding between the patient and the doctor and the doctor and the patient. It's really an unfortunate shift in how medicine is practiced and administered.
Well, Elaine, I do kind of want to wrap our conversation back to where it began, you know, the influence of the creative field on the medical field. You've talked about a play by Edward Albee, The Death of Bessie Smith. You know, a play that highlights the disparities in healthcare access and the consequences of, you know, discrimination. They ended up dying because, you know, one white hospital wouldn't intake them. As, you know, we improve the data sets being introduced to AI, and this is what they're learning off of, you know, removing that bias where possible. Just in general, to be better for ourselves, how should we address inequalities in healthcare access to move towards a more inclusive healthcare system?
I believe that the medical system, that is the training of doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals, needs to be more inclusive so that people seeking care or needing care that would encounter providers whom they trust, whose views and experiences resonate with their own. I think, unfortunately, that a lot of distrust in doctors is based on a legacy of racism and other prejudices by healthcare professionals, and that really is built in the healthcare system over many years. I don't think I appreciated how much bias there is in the field of medicine, or was, until I wrote my book and I looked at the treatment of people who essentially offered to participate in research, or who unknowingly ended up being experimented upon in medical institutions in the United States. I mean, everyone knows about the Tuskegee experiment, but really there were many less famous incidents like that. And so there are communities where there's deep distrust of providers, and that contributes to inequity. And unfortunately, I think doctors have their own prejudices, and they are sometimes, in some communities, often biased in the treatments they may offer different people. Also, economic barriers to healthcare are very real, and I don't think you need me to explain that. There are also geographic barriers to equitable care. So there are people who live in rural areas where it's hard to physically reach a doctor for evaluation and treatment. So there are all these different things that lead to people getting lesser care than they might otherwise. Doctors need perhaps to be more self-aware of their biases and to overcome those. And patients also, if they were educated, I think, you know, if we had better public education in North America. I was reading an article yesterday about science education in the United States, which is really falling behind that in other countries. And that's unfortunate, because if people don't understand science, I think they'll have less trust in their doctors and the recommendations that their doctors might give. That leads to inequitable care. I mean, if you think about COVID, right, and people's, you know, vaccine hesitation, I believe that if more people were educated about the immune system and how vaccines work and understood statistics also, so when they hear about, you know, reports and that studies that are talked about in news, they would be more accepting of what their doctors say and those results. But unfortunately, we have huge differences here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world, and those are barriers to equitable care. I think that doctors having more time for each patient, and with less of an economic focus, if the doctors were compensated by salary and not by, you know, how many procedures they did, if they could spend more time just talking with their patients, that would help patients to receive better care. And they would, the doctors, by knowing their patients' values better, would could better match their patients' needs, not just about a particular cancer type. Those are scientific knowledge gaps, if you will, but then there are social knowledge gaps that should be bridged and could be bridged, I think, if we could listen to each other better. So I think it's a huge task to reduce inequity in healthcare. I think the internet is helping in that people are, you know, many people who have cancer and other conditions are taking it upon themselves to learn what they want, to find information on their own, and to find doctors who meet their needs, both in terms of medical expertise and in terms of values. I guess the greater point is that I think that openness will help and education would help and awareness by doctors of the history of inequity in medical care, including cancer care, would help reduce those faults that have a long history.
Yeah, I recently had this conversation with Adam Lee Spencer, and we talked about representation in journalism for sports and how most of the sports journalists were, I don't know if you ever watched the show Everybody Loves Raymond, but pretty much Ray Romano's character in that show, you know, white male over 40. And when you look at the representation of sports, that's not what it is. I mean, maybe in hockey, maybe, you know, in some other sports, the majority of the four major sports here, at least in the US, is a representation of Black athletes, brown athletes, white athletes. But when you're telling somebody's story from the perspective of you growing up as, I mean, I am a white man, but if you're telling the story of a Black athlete or a brown athlete from my perspective, it's going to be very, very different from the perspective of a Black journalist or a brown journalist telling that story. And it goes to the medical field as well. It goes to really any field in the world, is the importance of representation and why it matters and the importance of being able to access stories from within your own culture, from within your own, you know, demographic, the ability to see yourself, somebody that looks like you, somebody that sounds like you, as a doctor, as an athlete, as a journalist, as a podcaster, is so important, because in that moment you can say, well, if they did it, so can I. And then, I mean, even getting back to this whole conversation we're having today, it does stem from the importance of a better education system, a reshift in our focus on, you know, I remember growing up, for me, and at least I can tell this story from my own personal experience, like everybody wanted to be an astronaut. Everyone wanted to be a doctor, a lawyer, you know, an athlete, obviously, of course. But nowadays, at least from, once again, my perception, those goals have shifted to be, I want to be an influencer. I want to be an actor. I want to be a celebrity. I want to be famous. We've completely shifted the tone of how we're structuring future generations because of, obviously, what's popular in the zeitgeist now. And I think we need that reshift back to being like, hey, I want to be a librarian. I want to be a doctor. I want to be this, this, and this. I want to be an astronaut. I think it'd be so freaking cool to be an astronaut. And I think we need to do that reshift. And I don't know, you know, obviously social media plays a huge part in that, but it does come from having more representation and saying and opening the doors for more people to walk in. Obviously, becoming a doctor is a very expensive risk. I mean, you're taking on 8 years of medical school, then I mean, and I'm basing most of this information from Scrubs, Elaine, so don't, if I'm wrong, please correct me. But then, you know, residency, and it takes a while to get to a point in your career where you're able to pay off those loans, where you're able to live a comfortable life. And if you don't have the support system that others with, you know, a more privilege have had, that is a tough course to become a doctor. And so I think it's removing, or trying to remove, those barriers, or at least making those barriers not as high, to allow more people of color, to allow more people of different, you know, sexualities, different religions, to feel comfortable jumping into a space that they otherwise felt that they couldn't be included in.
Diversity is crucial, as you say, in the workforce, in the medical workforce and the cancer workforce, if you will. I firmly believe that. And I think lowering the cost of medical education would help very much. You were talking about perception of doctors earlier and attitudes about cancer. And maybe I could offer a story that I used to work really long hours, and I would sometimes go back to the hospital after dinner with my family to like finish rounding and notes and like stuff that I had to do. And then I would take a cab home because it was dark and late. And often cab drivers, I always talk to cab drivers. I live in Manhattan and I don't take cabs much anymore, but I used to take them then. They would see me coming out of the hospital and they would say, no one ever thought I was a nurse ever. But they would say, what kind of doctor are you? Are you a doctor? What kind of doctor are you? And I would say, I'm an oncologist. And that would just, you know, a long time ago, that would elicit just so much emotion and respect. So, oh, you know, my father had this or my wife, I'd hear sad stories. More than a few times, cab drivers had me look at something. Can you look at this on my neck? But then in more recent years, somehow if it comes up that I was an oncologist, oh, you must have made a lot of money. It's a pattern to me that the sort of what used to be just absolute respect, almost reverence for someone who was an oncologist. How do you deal with that? All the death, you know, to just, oh, you must make a lot of money would be a common refrain now. And that saddens me. And I think it says something about what is said in public about cancer medicine and doctors in general. As I see it, most doctors are not overpaid for their work.
You know, in the restaurant business, I say, we're not saving lives here. It's not, something's not that important. But when you are a doctor, you are saving lives and it is important.
And, you know, I used to work crazy hours. I worked as hard as I possibly could. I gave it everything. And most of my colleagues did too. It was fun in the way that it was challenging. And you felt that, I felt that the decisions I was making made a difference. I every day it was really great in a way because you felt like what you did mattered. And I really enjoyed that. But it's different now, I think. There's much more anger, unfortunately.
Well, and I think it goes back to what you were saying, you know, the lack of trust. Because, and I mean, where does that lack of trust come from? It comes from fear. And where does, you know, fear come from? It comes from a lack of education. You know, obviously we can speak to COVID because the whole world experienced that. But, you know, the fact that we didn't know what this was for quite a while. And then when we did kind of know what it was, how it was perceived or how it was told to the general audience was confusing at times. Should we be wearing masks? Should we not be wearing masks? Now we're okay to wear masks. Now we don't need to wear masks. And it did. I mean, I think it played upon a lot of fears that people already had lingering in terms of my safety, the safety of my family, the safety of my friends, my coworkers. And we got to this point where, you know, it was a lot easier to just trust, I mean, another talking head instead of doing that extra research to be like, okay, what is mRNA? You know, never mind. I won't look into it. I'll just trust somebody who's saying it. And obviously in this space I'm in, I understand the importance of putting out information and obviously doing deep dives on my guests and deep dives on the research, but not everyone with a platform is willing to do that same work. And it does create this sense of fear with the lack of information. You start, you know, trusting certain people. And then obviously I think, you know, Russell Brand's kind of career arc has shown this, the fact that when you get to the certain points, you realize saying, oh, we need to be better with each other. We need to be nicer to each other. It doesn't make a ton of money because everyone knows that. But then you start playing into people's fears and you realize how much money you can make in that sphere because, well, what's happening today? Oh my gosh, you need to listen into what I'm saying to know what's happening in the world because otherwise you're going to be left out. And so I do think when it comes to education and being able to have these conversations, it is so important to take that extra time to really care about the conversation and really care about what's being said. Because at the end of the day, fear is easy to capitalize on. Being a good person, adding goodness to the world, it does take more effort, but it's worth the effort. And I think we've gotten now to a point in time where people don't want to put in the effort. Our attention spans have gone down the drain. And I do think we just need to somehow kick our butts out of this trance we are in. And I'm hoping, you know, having better conversations and having conversations with individuals like yourself, Elaine, can do that. But I know that process is going to take time.
Yeah. With social media and doctors, public communication now, the public and including patients are much more aware of controversies in the medical community. So doctors now will debate many issues publicly. I mean, you mentioned masks, and I think I mentioned vaccines earlier. But with cancer care, you know, whether a new drug is worth it or not, whether genomic testing is worth it or not, those are all contentious issues. Or mammography some time ago, whether it caused more harm than good. I believe it's valuable, just to be sure. But when people hear those arguments among doctors, that makes them less trustful. And I think there's no way around that. I mean, it's not that you can't hide those discussions anymore. Doctors used to have arguments at closed meetings, and doctors, you know, medical meetings used to be places where patients were not welcome. But now everything is recorded, and whether people use the platform that was formerly known as Twitter or other outlets, there's a lot of open discussion and argument among medical professionals and experts about preventive care and treatment for cancer. And hearing those arguments, understandably, would make people wary, because about most issues in medicine, there is disagreement. And unfortunately, the way that the internet works, those who have disputative views tend to get the most attention. You hear about the arguments out of proportion. You know, if 9 doctors out of 10 think X and 1 doctor thinks Y, you will hear about Dr. Y's view. There's no way around that. I don't think that controversy should be hidden from the public, quite the opposite. But it's understandable that people are less passive in accepting what doctors tell them. And I think it's great that people ask questions now and, you know, look for second opinions and do reading on their own.
Well, Elaine, I think, you know, as long as people continue to have good conversations like you and I had today, I think there's a path forward. It might be a small path. I just watched Dune yesterday, so maybe not a holy war. I want to be very clear, not a holy war, but there is a potential path forward. Elaine, I want to thank you for taking the time to share your perspective on some of the strangest and most bizarre news stories the world has to offer in an engaging, productive, and meaningful conversation. Listeners, if you'd like to continue to hear more from Elaine and her current work, take a moment to check out her latest book, From Whispers to Shouts. You can do so by following her through her website, www.elaineshatner.com. Once again, www.elaineshatner.com. And of course, those links will be included in the episode description and on our podcast website, www.watercoolertalkpod.com. So Elaine, we have now gone to my favorite part of the show, the segment where I hand off the show, one listener called Good or Bad, a podcast experience like no other. Over to you to close it out however you see fit. You know, given that your latest book focuses on the public perception built around cancer, I think it's, you know, really only right that you end our conversation with a reflection on the power of storytelling to shape our understanding of complex issues and really just, you know, leave listeners with a curiosity to explore the topic further. So Elaine, the mic is hot, the light shine bright, and the floor is yours.
Well, Adam, first, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking. What can I say? I'm in my 60s, and I'm still learning every day. I run a book group, something we didn't talk about. And by reading of others' experiences, both fiction and also memoirs and real things that happen to other people and what they share, I appreciate things in my life and about the world around me. Stories give me optimism, and they also are a way of processing information. And as science advances, as treatments in medicine get better, one way that we'll learn about those is through the stories that people tell. And, well, I'm grateful for the people who have shared their stories with me, and I'm appreciative of you for letting me get to speak here. I think we can all learn from one another. And that makes me optimistic about the future.
Well, Elaine, I think you truly, truly nailed it. And I think we created a great conversation here today. And I'm so appreciative of you coming on the show, of you sharing your stories, sharing your perspectives, and obviously having, like I said, I mean, I know cancer is something that if you haven't been affected by it, you know somebody who's been impacted by it. And so I think conversations like these are so important because everybody knows somebody, or everybody has a story or has a personal story that has changed their life. And I think as we have better conversations and build better perceptions around cancer that's not this big bad. I think, you know, slowly, to be completely honest, but slowly over time, I think movies and TV shows and AI and we'll get better at telling the correct stories. Listeners, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, the show will be over. Peace.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.